The tape is rolling now. Speaking with Edgar Carret, whose new book is Suddenly a Knock on the Door. I've heard that you didn't start writing short stories until after a very traumatic event that happened while you were serving your compulsory military duty in the Israeli army. Can you tell me what happened?
My best friend who served with me in the same base became heavily depressed, and he shot himself. He killed himself. And I found him after he shot himself.
Wow. Do you know why? I mean, depression, obviously, but was there something about serving in the military, do you think?
I think it's a lot of things. I think that whenever somebody kills himself, then we look for this kind of exclusive reason, because it makes people feel safe. Because let's say, if I would say, yeah, it was because he was in the military, and so you can say, okay, I'm not in the military, I'm safe, you know. If I would say it's because his girlfriend left him, you'd say, oh, my girlfriend didn't leave me, I'm safe, you know. But I think there was something very existential in that suicide, and that what was so threatening about it. Because, you know, if there's somebody you really love and you're really close to and he kills himself, then you say, so actually, why don't I do the same thing, you know? And I think that when I started writing, it was basically a way of putting it on paper, saying, this is why I want to live. This is what life means to me.
Now, the story that I've heard about your friend's suicide is even more complicated for you. Apparently, shortly before he did this, he asked you to give him reasons for why he shouldn't kill himself. And if you couldn't come up with a reason, he said he was going to do it.
Yeah. It didn't happen like the same day, but we had a few talks about the fact that he wanted to kill himself. And whenever he would mention it, I say, don't do it. And I would say, you know, we're all going to miss you. You're going to break my heart. You're going to break your entire family's heart, you know. And he said, you know, I'm sorry, but this isn't a good enough reason to keep on living. And he said, give me a good reason, you know. And these are the kind of things that are tough to articulate. You know, it's something personal. It's these kind of things that you can't put in words. But sometimes you can put them in the shape of a story, you know, because I think a story many times is a way of kind of saying those things that you can't put out in one sentence, because it can carry all those ambiguity and complexity of a statement that you like, why am I living, you know?
So he asked you to give him reasons for why he should continue living, and you couldn't come up with a good enough reason. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, because again, you know, it's tough to say to somebody else, you know, because I could say, I don't know, because surfing is great, and he would say, you know, I don't like surfing, you know. It's not that easy.
Yeah. So,
and I was very young at the time. I don't know what I would have done today, but I was 19 at the time.
Wow. So did that incident actually cause you to become a writer?
I wrote my first story a couple of weeks after he committed his suicide. You know, I don't know, maybe I would have started writing anyway, but my life was going to an entirely different direction. I was serving in a computer unit. I was a math major. I was supposed to learn math and computers, and you know, I never wrote anything in my life before that, so I don't know, maybe if you wouldn't have done it, today I would be some computer engineer or do something else. I'm not sure.
And it's worth pointing out that the subject of suicide is a recurring theme in your fiction. You wrote a novella dealing with the subject, which was the basis of the film Wrist Cutters, a love story. And the subject of suicide comes up in your new collection of short stories, Suddenly a Knock on the Door. does this all go back to your friend's suicide, or is there something else that draws you to this subject?
Well, I think that suicide is always a very strong metaphor for many things, but mostly for talking about life as a choice. I think that many times when you live your life, you know, and you think that, I don't know, things are not working, everything sucks, and you say, why is it happening to me, you know? And there is this sentence, you know, born never asked, that I think many people kind of can live their life in a very grumpy and unhappy kind of way. But the moment that you internalize that your life is a choice, you know, you could take your own life in every given minute, then it means that if you leave them and if you chose to leave them, then you should take responsibility of them and kind of live a life worth living.
Wasn't it Camus who said the only serious question worth asking is whether to kill yourself?
I think that there are quite a few serious questions, but this is definitely one of them.
Yeah. Well, and one story in particular deals with suicide in your new book. It's called Not Completely Alone. Can you tell me about that story?
Well, it's a story told by a person who's in love with a woman who is not sexually attracted to him. And he keeps saying, you know, she keeps kind of seeing the relationship as a tragedy because she would have liked it to be a romantic one. But basically she's very, very close to him, yet has sex with other men. And in the story, it's just, apparently she had known other people before that who killed themselves because of her. And at some point, the narrator keeps telling the story, but he killed himself because of her, and he keeps telling that story even after his death.
Which is very eerie, because at one moment he's saying, you know, they recognized that he would find a woman who loved him back and, you know, he would leave her. And then the next thing we know, he is telling the story from beyond the grave.
Yeah, and I think the story is very much about that character, that female character, that in a very strange and unconscious way, it kind of builds her ego or self-importance by the number of people who killed themselves for her.
Now, your stories are rooted in reality, but you have all these kinds of fantastical elements in them. You know, there's one story with a talking goldfish, another, there's a small zipper under a man's tongue that his girlfriend unzips to discover that there's an entirely different man underneath. There's a kind of dreamlike logic in a lot of these stories, which I suppose we would call surrealism. And you have been often called a surrealist writer. Do you think that label fits you?
Yeah, I mean, it fits me to some extent, but I think that you can use surrealism in many different ways. You know, I think that, many people talk about magic realism when you kind of break realism to get this feeling of uplift, you know, and optimism, and that feeling of beauty that comes from the fantastic. But I don't think that's the case in my stories. I think that there is something very mundane about the unrealistic things in my stories, but many times they're just kind of a way or a path to talk about something that is actually very simple and very everyday like, but I kind of take a detour and do it through some sort of a fantastical situation. But you know, I'm saying sometimes my character needs somebody to tell him that he's wrong. And sometimes in my stories, it would be a goldfish that would tell him that and not his mother. But that's purely circumstantial.
Is it a way to get at something that's more real, do you think, by bringing in these fantastical elements?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think that there is something about a realistic art that is kind of overrated. I think it's a perfectly legitimate choice, and I love a lot of, let's say, a lot of literature that is realistic. But I think that when you write, you write something that is completely subjective. You know, it doesn't matter even if you write in a third person narrative. You write what you feel, and sometimes the stuff that you feel is not realistic. And my commitment is to truth. It's not to the laws of physics. You know, so if I want to follow some sort of an inner truth, and it will take me in a route that is fantastical, I'll happily take that route. It's not a goal, you know. It's just a mean to get somewhere.
I'm wondering how much of this, well, you wouldn't call it surrealist quality in your fiction, but whatever it is, this sort of fantastical nature of so many of your stories, how much of that is rooted in your own personal story, the fact that you are the son of Holocaust survivors, and from what I've heard, that your parents tried to pass as Israeli-born Jews. Is that an element, do you think, in the kind of fiction that you write?
I think that the fact that my parents were Holocaust survivors certainly affected the way that I've written. You know, I think that they always carried a different perspective about life and humanity and civilization, and many things that I, let's say, most people take for granted, they really they knew otherwise. It's like my mother said, you know, that when you sit with people at the table and they use a fork to eat the food from their plate and not from yours, or they don't use it to stab you, then, you know, then it's great. But just know that it can be different too, you know. And the strange thing about them is that they were very optimistic, they were very liberal and very loving, but at the same time, they knew a wider scope of existence that had, you know, that touched kind of that ultimate darkness of the Second World War. And I think that this kind of idea of not taking things for granted, asking myself what would have happened if this wouldn't happen, but something else would happen instead, is this kind of a reflex that I got from growing up with Holocaust survivors.
Well, just to cite that example that you just mentioned, I mean, sitting under the dinner table and your parents mentioning, well, you know, it's good that, you know, someone wouldn't use that fork to stab you. I mean, that would never occur to me, for instance. But I suppose
My mother survived the Warsaw Ghetto. She saw her mother and her little brother killed in front of her own eyes. Her father died. She basically survived the war and took care of herself, you know, as a 7-year-old alone in this world, you know. And she saw many things that I would be happy if no human being had to see, but she did. And the amazing thing about it, that, you know, that she came out an amazing storyteller, a great dancer, you know, and one of the most amazing people I've ever met. And this, she never carried with her any sense of victimhood or let's say, bitterness at mankind. She understood that people could do wrong, but felt all the time that they can also do right, and she hoped that they'll do right, you know. And I think that there is something that from this in my stories, because things can be very, very violent and aggressive and vicious in my stories, but deep underneath it, there is this layer that knowing that people could do otherwise, you know, that I think that at any given moment, you know, we could do better, and we might.
And my sense is that part of what you're reacting against as an Israeli writer is the sense that the Holocaust defines everything about what it means to be an Israeli, and, you know, translated that into fiction, that you don't want that to be your identity.
Well, you know, a week ago I had a meeting I gave a lecture to the chief of staff and all the generals of the Israeli army, and they mentioned that many army officers have the picture of Israeli Air Force airplanes flying over the Auschwitz gate to remember the past. And I said to the chief of general that for me, a picture of a piece of metal flying over a piece of metal is not such an important memory, you know, and the picture of a child raising his hands, you know, this famous Holocaust icon, is something that I would want to see in all those generals' offices. Because I think that if there's a legacy from the Holocaust, I wouldn't want to take a legacy that, you know, that we should always be strong and be able to defend ourselves against all evil. This is important too, but the legacy is really that the heroes of the Holocaust were people who had shown personal courage. There were people who looked at some reality around them and they say, you know what, the system wants me to do one thing, but I won't do it, even if I endanger my life. And for me, let's say a Jewish army that I would wish to have would be an army that would take everything can from that, you know. No, it's not the fact that we can bomb Auschwitz is makes me feel safer, but I think that having an army in a country that sees this Holocaust trauma as some kind of warning, saying, you know, we should be as moral as we can, you know, even at the risk of endangering ourselves, you know, we should survive, okay, but we shouldn't take any liberties when it comes to endangering innocent people or just doing things, going through the motions, not asking yourself the difficult questions that you can ask.
I'm curious about your literary influences because your work has often been compared to Franz Kafka's novels. Is Kafka a big influence on you?
Yes, and I also love his short fiction. You know, I think that people know him more by his novels, but his short fiction is amazing.
Hmm. What is it that you like about Kafka?
I find him a very moral writer. And you know, I think many times people are moralistic and they confuse being moralistic with being moral. But Kafka is moral in the most raw sense. You know, it kind of reading his fiction is like getting a slap to your face. You know, so it kind of wakes you up to your own life. You know, it's after reading a Kafka story, when you look at the people around you, the world around you, you see them in a different way. And it kind of breaks this force of inertia. And I think that the force of inertia is a very dangerous force morally. You know, let's say if you're used to doing something, if you're used to ignoring, I don't know, the homeless person down your street or you know, going next to something that shouldn't be done and not doing anything about it, that after reading a Kafka story, it will become difficult again.
Well, and I'm thinking for a writer then, I mean, if you take that model, in a sense, as your mission as a writer, it's, I suppose, to break cliches. I mean, that's sort of then the mission of what it means to write literature, to not fall into the way other people have told stories.
Yeah, well, it's not even not falling to the way that other people told story. It's basically not going to any conventions of seeing life in a certain way, you know, because life tends to be this kind of a package. You know, I talked about homeless people, right? So, for example, we have this agreement that if you go in the street and you pass next to a homeless person, you can give him a dollar, okay? But he's not a dollarless person. He's a homeless person. But you wouldn't even consider taking him home. And, you know, and it makes sense. Like, who wants to bring a perfect stranger home? But the fact that you pass next to a homeless person, realize that he's going to sleep there outside, realize that, you know, that in the compromise that you make in life, you won't take him home. And then saying, you know what, at least I can give him a dollar. If you go through this process, you know, you're in an authentic point. But most people don't, even very generous people who give that homeless person a dollar every day.
So if we were to talk about other literary influences, who else? Kurt Vonnegut? Is he one of your influences?
Yeah, I've read Kurt Vonnegut during basic training. You know, during my compulsory army service, I went through basic training, and reading good Vonnegut and reading Kafka in the army, it's really good because it's nice to see that there are people that are even doing worse than you are.
I was thinking, are these really good people to read?
I would say, you know, I have a word in my head which I'm trying to avoid, you know, because I know that you're not supposed to say it in NPR, but it starts with an F and ends with an up, you know? So it's nice to know that there are more F-upped people than you are.
The real value of literature when you're in basic training. Now, one thing that's striking about a lot of your stories
I can mention, for example, listen, my duty as a writer is that if I'm in NPR, then I refer to the fact during our interviews that there are certain words that I can't say in an interview. And, you know, and it's okay. I'm not even saying if it's good or bad, but I think that it's good for listeners whenever they listen to NPR, realize that, you know, that if somebody want to say a word, he has to choose it when he's on NPR. And that's many times the things that you do when you write fiction.
Good point. I mean, in other words, you want to make the process a little more transparent.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting you say that because a lot of your stories are, to some degree, about the art of storytelling. There's a meta quality to them. And a perfect example is your title story, Suddenly a Knock on the Door. Can you tell me about what happens in this story?
Oh, it's the opening story in the collection. And when I started writing this collection, I wanted it to have some sort of an Arabian Night kind of structure in which basically the storyteller keeps telling stories to survive, which is something that I feel very strongly, you know, because I feel that especially when you live in the Middle East and there is a lot of violence and arbitrariness all around you, then basically the fact that you can take a few arbitrary things and connect them by some sort of an invented plot and suddenly they make sense and suddenly the guy who slapped you in the street had a reason to do it, you know, then for me, it was from early on a mechanism of survival. So I've written this story about this writer that people start coming to his apartment and try to make him tell them story at gunpoint.
Which he doesn't really want to do, but he doesn't have any choice.
Oh, he has a choice. You know, they say it's either a story or a bullet to the head, you know, so he has a choice.
Well, could you read us an excerpt from this story?
Great. I stop short and take a deep breath. Both of them are staring at me. How do I always get myself into these situations? I bet things like this never happened to Amos Oz or David Grossman. Suddenly, there's a knock on the door. Their gaze turns menacing. I shrug. It's not about me. There's nothing in my story to connect it to that knock. Get rid of him, the poster orders me. Get rid of him, whoever it is. I open the door just a crack. It's a pizza delivery guy. Are you Carrot? He asks. Yes, I say, but I didn't order a pizza. It says here 14 Zamenhof Street. He snaps, pointing at the printed delivery slip and pushing his way inside. So what, I say? I didn't order a pizza. Family size, he insists. Half pineapple, half anchovy, prepaid, credit card. Just give me my tip and I'm out of here. Are you here for a story too? The Swede interrogates. Sorry. Are you here for a story too? The Swede interrogates. What story? The pizza guy asks. But it's obvious he's lying. He's not very good at it. Pull it out, the poster prods. Come on, out with the pistol already. I don't have a pistol, the pizza guy admits awkwardly and draws a cleaver out from under his cardboard tray. But I cut him into julienne strips unless he coughs up a good one on the double. The three of them are on the sofa. The Swede on the right, then the pizza guy. Then the poster. I can't do it like this, I tell them. I can't get a story going with the three of you here and your weapons and all that. Go take a walk around the block And by the time you get back, I'll have something for you. The bastard's gonna call the cops, the poster tells the Swede. What's he thinking, that we were born yesterday? Come on, give us one and we'll be on our way, the pizza guy begs. A short one. Don't be so anal. Things are tough, you know. Unemployment, suicide bombings, Iranians. People are hungry for something else. What do you think brought law-abiding guys like us this far? We're desperate, man. Desperate.
That is great. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And we will, we can easily make some edits there to clean that up, so that is not a problem. Now, near the beginning of that story, you write, your narrator says, I'm someone who writes stories, not someone who tells them, and even that isn't something that I do on demand. And I'm wondering if those lines have some personal meaning for you. I mean, you've been very successful, and whether you feel more pressure to produce more work more often.
Well, I think that the thing that saves me from any kind of pressure when it comes to my writing is that really I don't know how to write a story. I don't have any writing discipline. I don't write every day. I would say that I don't even have a real writing technique. It's just that sometimes when a story comes, I sit down and I write it down. So let's say if my publisher says to me, how about you write a novel because novels sell better, then I don't even have a dilemma. I don't know how to write a novel. Or if somebody says to me, how about you write a story this week, I can't force myself to write. You know, it's always like I like to compare the writing process to trust falls. You know these things when couples go to counseling and they ask one of them to fall back and the other one is supposed to catch him before he hits the ground. So with me, writing is kind of a trust fall, you know. I kind of fall back and wait for a story to catch me. So if it doesn't, you know, then you get a bump on your head. And if you insist and you fall again, then you get another bump on your head. But it won't get any writing done. So when I write about those people who are trying to force me to write, I think that, you know, all those people are just me. And sometimes when there is a situation where I feel that there are all those kind of things that I cannot articulate, that I speak with this voice of somebody who's about to burst in tears in a minute and I don't know why, and I sit down and no story comes, you know, this is when I want a story to be written. This is when I would like to put a gun to my head if it would get that story written.
And it's also striking that your stories are incredibly short. I mean, it's not just that you're not writing novels. You're not writing 30-page stories either. I mean, often your short stories are just 2 pages long or maybe, you know, 6 or 7 pages long.
Yeah. I think that the strongest drive I have when I write is curiosity. You know, I'm much more a reader of my stories than a writer of them. You know, the only reason I write them is so I have something to read, you know. It's like it's all like those cartoons when you see those guys that they run off the cliff and they have a pencil and they keep kind of drawing some ground so they won't fall. So when I write a story and let's say I start writing a description about a tree, you know, I don't know, in autumn, then there is this side of me saying, come on, I want to know what's going to happen next, you know. I want to, there is a passion behind each story, and this passion kind of keeps pushing me forward.
The more I hear you talk about this, I mean, it almost goes back to the beginning of our conversation about your friend who couldn't find a reason to keep on living. I mean, there's sort of this, it sounds like this existential drive for you to write. I mean, you have to write is what it sounds like.
Yeah, for sure. Let's say if there are periods in which I have no need to write, then I'm happy. You know, if I could make this deal that, you know, that I'll feel good with myself and be kind of a good person and I won't write a word till the day I die, I think it's a good deal. You know, for me, I think many times art is a way of dealing with some sort of a handicap. You know, it's like, if you can do everything right in life, you don't sit in a room and write stuff that never really happened. You know, it's always the plan B. So you know, so if you kind of reconcile with things, if you like, you do something horrible and then you write a story to repent, if there was this moment where you didn't have the courage to do something and you write a story about that, if there's something that you don't understand and you write about it, you need to have a problem, you know, to write. And I'm saying, you know, let's say if the deal is not having any problem, not writing, it's a good one. And if the deal is having problems and writing them down, it's also a fair deal. It's those situations when you have problems and you can't write that are the difficult ones.
You have just made the case better than anyone I've ever heard for the root of all writing is neuroses.
Well, you know, the problem, I think, with writing is that there is too much respectability around. I think that for many people, writers, they are kind of like some sort of secular popes, you know? They are those holy men, you know, those important guys. But I think that when it comes down to it, the reason that we like reading a book is because there are people there who share their weaknesses with us, you know? They don't even necessarily have to be smarter than us. If they feel and if they have this human frailty and if they know how to articulate it, that's what makes them a writer. You know, I'm saying, like, you know, I love reading Philip Roth. You know, I'm not sure I would want him as a neighbor in my building or as my foreign minister or as my prime minister. Or I'm not even sure I would want him to watch my kid, you know, if I have to go around the block to buy something at a supermarket. And I think that that there was some process in history that made kind of writers important people. You know, I think maybe what people write can be important, but the people themselves are just guys who know how to write.
So if I understand what you're saying, it sounds like writing does not necessarily make you happy. I mean, you may not even enjoy the process, but it's something you have to do for whatever reason. I mean, to deal with your own demons, perhaps.
Well, with me, it makes me very happy. But let's say if I use a metaphor, let's say if you're all cramped and you go to a masseuse, then it makes you happy, you know, and you feel this kind of, it's like this good pain because he's kind of bringing your body into a good starting position. But if you don't get cramped at all, it's even better.
Now, we were talking about the often the very self-reflective aspect of your writing. And sometimes your stories are about stories. And there's one that makes this point very explicitly, very short story called The Story, Victorious, which you say at the very beginning, it's the best story in the world. Tell me about this story.
Well, it's kind of I think that many times when I read fiction or I see art, I feel a very strong ego behind it. You know, sometimes you can read a page and under it there is some layer of the writing saying, "Whoa, I'm so smart! I came up with this metaphor." You know, and I think that this story is a little bit of kind of exposing this mechanism when the entire story just talks about how important and wonderful and great it is. You know, and it's kind of half a story, half a commercial, half a game show, you know. And if it would have been a page longer, it would turn into this hairy, lovely pet that would jump into your lap.
So, I mean, it's sort of it's a critique of how fiction is sometimes commercialized in some way, or the expectations that people have for what a writer is supposed to do.
Well, I kind of wrote it from a writer's perspective because sometimes, you know, like all people, when I write, I can become very full of myself. You know, I can say, wow, you know, wow, this is a great story. You know, like sometimes I say to my wife, you got to read this story that I wrote. It's really amazing. And she looks at me and she said, did you put dishes in the dishwater washer? I said to her, what? I said, the dishwasher. And I said, the story, okay, I'll read it tomorrow. And then it gets me into perspective, you know, because you know, there's something very vain about writing. And I think these stories kind of makes a parody of this vanity because basically, I don't think you can write from modesty, because if you're so modest, then why do you take something that's inside you and put it in a public sphere unless you think it's important for the reader or for the entire human race or for a bunch of aliens who live on distant planet and they're just studying English right now just so they can read you, you know? So you have this kind of feeling of not omnipotence, but this huge importance when you write. And I was kind of making a joke out of it.
It's a wonderful story, as all of your stories are. Anyway, thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Your stories really are wonderful. So anyway, Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, sure. To follow up on what you were just saying about sort of your need to write or not, I was surprised to read in a recent article in which you said that you enjoy writing, but it's not a goal. So I guess I'm wondering if you could imagine living a happy life without writing.
I can imagine it like as a concept, but you know, but I never got the manual. I just don't know exactly how to do it. But look, you know, there's so many happy moments in my life, you know, when I play with my child, when I'm with my family. I know what it means to be happy. I don't need to write to be happy, but I guess at the same time, I'm not that good at being happy, I'm afraid. I wish I would have been a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. So can you imagine what you would do if you weren't writing?
Give interviews about books I've never written. No, I just like... No, I think I would mostly kind of... I would... You know, the thing that makes me the happiest is being with people. I like being with people. I like being with my family. I like being with friends. I like meeting other people who are nice and find me funny and don't try to beat me up with blunt objects, you know? It's like...
Well, but I think you will keep writing. So anyway, thank you. This has been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good. I hope you enjoy your time in this country.
Oh, I already am. It's like I just wait for my luggage, and the moment my luggage will arrive, it will be perfect.
That's not very much fun not having your luggage. So anyway, well, good luck on that front. So
thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, yeah, bye-bye.